My name's Albert Myers, and I'm an alcoholic. And in closing, by the grace of God and the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people like you and conferences like this, and my pretty Al-Anon wife, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September the 7th of 1973, and for that I'm eternally grateful. I love your theme, sobriety. It's a great life. It's just an unbelievable life when you have somebody like Tracy to stand up and tell you how this thing works. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Jim and Dick and all of the people responsible for the invitation. It is a great honor for Sally and myself to be here. And I want to thank Bill and Carolyn for picking us up at the airport today. We arrived at about 10:30, and I think our luggage went on to Seattle. And it arrived about an hour ago, so what you see is a suit that has just been pressed, and I'm here, and I'm just glad to be here. I bumped into a young gal a little earlier today, and I said, "How long have you been in the program?" And she said, "A little over a month." I said, "What do you think?" And she said, "Well, it's a little like mop and glow. It cleans and shines at the same time." I hadn't really thought of it that way, but that's about the way it works. And I enjoyed so much Jim earlier in the day. And for those of you that don't know, Jim has been very instrumental in my sobriety and has sponsored me from time to time when I really needed it. Jim meant what he said this morning. And I remember when I first asked Jim to be my sponsor, we talked a little bit, and there is a little bit of Clancy in him. I'll tell you that right now. And he said, "I know you've been around the program for a while, and I know you don't need to take a four-step, but he said, have a 10-step to me in 2 weeks, or we won't be doing this anymore." And I said, "Oh, okay, Jim, you know." So he does practice what he preaches, and I'm a little startled at the Indian princess. I've never heard that before. I've known Vinoy for a long time, but I had Jim's permission to call her the Indian princess. And if you weren't here today to listen to Vinoy, it was a very courageous talk, and one that needed to be said. The pretty Al-Anon that I referred to last 19th of June, we were married 40 years, so I have a very strong Al-Anon lady with me here. As a matter of fact, this is a little nostalgic for me because Sally and I are basically Iowa farm kids. She's from Des Moines and I'm from Iowa City. And and some 40 years ago in June, we were married in Des Moines, and we were going to spend the honeymoon night in Omaha. Somehow, we only got as far as Atlantic, and I was alcoholic even then. You know, I was talking to some of the others when I first started traveling on the road. My first sales job was covering the state of Nebraska and part of Iowa, and I used to stay at the Paxton Hotel, and get pretty drunk and then head for North Platte and Ogallala and Scotts Bluff and occasionally get a sandstorm and Broken Bow. So I have a history of your state, and I'm pleased to be here to make my amends. What goes around comes around, I guess. I have always had a feeling of inadequacy, and I have that little sensation tonight as I'm standing up here that I'm just overwhelmed by your gratitude and your invitation, and I'm not really sure how to pay that back. And I've always had the feeling that I've been addicted to approval a long time before I was ever addicted to alcohol. People talk to me about my attitude, and people talk to me about my behavior a long time before they ever talk to me about my drinking. And, you know, when you're addicted to approval, at least for me, you become very easy to manipulate. And I found myself doing things that I didn't want to do with people that I really didn't want to be with and places that I really didn't want to go. And I always had that sensation that I was better than you or not as good as you, or I looked up to you or looked down to you, but I could never feel comfortable. It just was never a part of my being. And I remember that I drank in high school and in college, and I drank in the war, the big one, the one that Archie Bunker calls the WW2. That was my war. And I remember I had taken basic training in Chicago at Great Lakes, and I had been shipped to a base in California called Camp Shoemaker. And we had been there about 3 weeks, and I had been given a weekend liberty. And two other fellas and myself hitchhiked over to a small town close by, and we started drinking on Friday evening, and we were supposed to be back to the base on Sunday. And they got back. I didn't get back until Tuesday. And I remember that people got very upset about that in the military. And some people came to the barracks and removed me from the barracks and took me to this provost marshal. And I remember one more time, you know, somebody was talking to me about my behavior. And during this conversation that I had with this officer, I remember at one point, just casually, the officer said to me, "By any chance, do you have a problem with drinking?" And I thought, God, how can that be? I'm 18 years old, and I'm an Iowa farm kid, and I'm miles away from home, and there's a war on, and people are shooting at each other, and I'm on this base with 95,000 other people, and if I could get out of here and get home and be with my family, I wouldn't feel the way I feel, and I wouldn't be afraid the way I'm afraid. And you know, that's what I thought up here. I'm 18 years old, that's not possible, but once again, people were talking to me about my behavior. I got out of the service and I got back to the University of Iowa in the fall of 1946, and I remember that I registered that fall, and I had to take some entrance examinations, and it frightened me. And I remember I solved that by going across the street to a place called the Airliner, and I had I see there's a couple of Airliner graduates in this group. And I remember that I had a few drinks, and you know, that sensation, that fear went away. And that's pretty much how I got through life. The alcohol just seemed to take the fear out of me all the time. And in January of 1947, I walked into a small Iowa tavern, and I saw the prettiest lady that I had ever seen, the gal you're going to hear a little later on in the evening. And I remember I saw Sally, and her beauty just startled me. She was absolutely the most stunning, beautiful woman that I had ever seen. And you know, in true alcoholic fashion, I looked at her and said, "That should be mine." Now, you know how we are. We don't court anything. We just capture it. And I just had one problem. At the time, I was engaged to another girl. And I've said many times, that's no problem for alcoholics. When we decide to go from there to there, we just go and we don't tell anybody. And I remember that I was with a fraternity brother, and he happened to know Sally. And I got her telephone number, and with the intensity of an alcoholic, I just pursued her for the next 3 weeks, and just around the clock. And I remember one night I had gotten drunk and bought a diamond ring, and I had called Sally at the dorm and said, "Could you meet me outside at 10:30? And she said, "Sure." And I was so drunk I could hardly get the car parked. And I remember Sally came out and got in the front seat of the car. And the car was moving a little bit, and I remember I took her hand and I put the ring on the wrong finger, and I said to her, "Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have me for the rest of your life?" I don't know what she's going to tell you later on this evening, but that evening she said yes. And, you know, it was interesting because we were married and we were two young, frightened kids, and that addiction that I had as an individual to approval, we took on as a couple. I remember our parents helped us buy our first little GI house out in 61st Street in Des Moines, and Sally and I didn't have any money, and on the weekends we would get in the car and we'd drive around neighborhoods that we couldn't afford, and we'd look at your houses. And I remember one time we saw this house with this red door and this brass kick plate, and we went home, painted our door red, and put on this brass kick plate. And then a week or two later, we'd drive around and we saw some shutters, and we bought shutters and put them on our house. And then we drove around and looked at your shrubbery, and then we bought shrubbery and put it in front of our house. And the trap that Sally and I were falling into was, we knew one day you would drive by our house and say, gee, that's a good looking house. And it should be. It looks just like yours. But the trap that we were falling into was, you know, if we look good on the outside, you would think we were okay on the inside. You know, the peculiar thing about it, although I've been in the program almost 15 years now, sobriety has not altered my thinking all that much. I'm still competitive, I'm still tenacious, I'm still compulsive, I'm not moderate about anything. I watch Sally open up those little bag of M&Ms and have two of those and put them back in her purse, and I don't know how she does that. Every roll of Lifesavers that I ever purchased, I intended to let each one of those melt in my mouth one at a time. And you know, it's never happened. As a matter of fact, Sally still hates to send me to the grocery store. We had the grandchildren at our house all last week, and Sally said, oh, I want to make the grandchildren some pancakes. Would you go down and get some eggs? And I said, sure. And I came back, and she said, how much was the eggs? And I said, $30. And the trouble is, as an alcoholic, I can't get those empty carts up and down the aisle without putting things in there. Because you don't understand, light bulbs and super glue and pant hangers are very important to me. And if I don't need them, I'm going to need them. You know. I'm convinced there's an alcoholic advertising executive somewhere in New York that says, if you want to sell every alcoholic in the world something, just put new and improved on it. I've always been in sales, and as such, Sally and I moved around a great deal. And you know, right after the war, you didn't talk about having a child. We talked about having children, and we have four. We have a daughter and three sons. And as a salesman, we were transferred. I was transferred a great deal in my job. And I remember each time that Sally and I had a chance to move, you know, we would just kind of get together in the kitchen and say, God, we have a chance to start over again. You know, we never really looked at the family and said, is this move going to hurt somebody? Is one of our youngsters going to have to move up a grade or back a grade or this kind of thing? You know, we didn't have that luxury because we had the disease of alcoholism in our home. You know, we're dealing with a disease powerful enough to kill people that don't have it. It's such a deceptive disease that by the time it deceives you and by the time you deny it, you can look right at it and say, that's not my problem. I used to think money was my problem. If I had enough money, I wouldn't have the problems. I mean, I don't know about you. My creditors never called and said, you're drinking too much. Hey, my creditors called and said, would you please make some payments? And every time Sally and I would talk about moving, we would always look for that tangible ingredient that's going to make it different this time. You know, we never had enough bedrooms, or the yard wasn't big enough, or we weren't close enough to the school. We were always looking for that tangible thing that was going to make it okay this time, and we never found it. I was working for a large corporation called Owens Corning Fiberglass, and I had received a nice promotion to go to New York, and I remember Sally and the four children and myself went to New York, and I went to my offices, and Sally went up to Westport, Connecticut, and found a lovely, lovely old home built in 1812 by a sea captain. It was just a lovely family home, and if you had stopped me on the streets in New York and said, Albert, how are things in your life? I would have looked you straight in the eye and said, wonderful. I mean, I have this beautiful wife and these four lovely children and this home up in Connecticut and this marvelous job, and you know, up here in my mind, I thought that's really what was going on. I had done everything that society had asked of me. It should have been okay. And somehow we were dying on the inside while we were living on the outside. I think every alcoholic knows that feeling of dying while they're living. And we were bleeding and we didn't know what was wrong. I remember one Friday night I came home and I was in bad condition. And as I came through the back door, Sally made some comment about my condition. And whenever I knew she was right, I would go into my alcoholic defense. And that was one-line sarcasm. Boy, I loved one-line sarcasm. You know, I could just sting you with it and tear the flesh and back you up, and it didn't show, and I could deny it. And I would just hit Sally with one line of sarcasm. I could just see her flinch and back up. And invariably, she would always react the same way. She would look at me and say, "Do you mean that?" And I would say, "Do I mean what?" "What you just said." "What did I just say?" "Well, you know what you said." "No, I don't. Tell me what you think you thought you heard." God, and then Sally would tell me what she thought she heard, and then I'd really go into my alcoholic routine, and I'd go, "Oh, God, you took it all wrong." I did not use that tone of voice. I did not say it like that. And if I could get her to talk long enough, invariably she would always say, "Albert, I'm really sorry for misunderstanding." And I would say, "By God, you should be, as hard as I work." Now, the insanity of that was, we didn't do that once in a while. We did that week after week, year after year. And we were just dying and didn't know what was wrong. I came home. I had been in Texas for 2 weeks traveling, and I came home on a Friday night, and I had leased a car and driven up to Connecticut, and I came through the back door. And that particular evening, Sally looked at me, and she didn't have much to say. She said, "I would just rather be dead than live with you." And there wasn't any conversation. There was something different about her look and her manner. And I remember kind of holding her and saying, "Hey, it's been a tough 2 weeks. Let's go to bed, and in the morning it'll look better." And I remember on a Saturday morning in Westport, Connecticut, the only lady that I have ever loved said, "I would rather be dead than live with you." And she took a razor blade that was sitting on top of our dresser, and she went to the master bath, and she talked about slashing her wrists and cutting her wrists and wanting to die. And I remember the tone of my voice picked up, and the intensity of the house began to take place, and I'm screaming and saying, "My God, Sally, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't kill yourself. You know, my drinking bothers you that much, I'll quit." And the four children that I talked about just a little earlier were standing right behind me as I was yelling at their mom saying, "Hey, please don't kill yourself." And I've been privileged to sponsor some Alateen groups since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was sponsoring a young boy by the name of Jack, and he was getting beaten up on a regular basis. And every Wednesday I would pick Jack up and we'd go for hamburgers. And one night he got in my car and I said to Jack, "Jack, how are things going?" And he said, "They sound pretty good." And I said, "What does that mean, Jack, they sound pretty good?" And he said, "Well, they sound pretty good." He said, "The disease of alcoholism has a sound to it." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No." He said, "That's how I defend myself." He said, "Mr. Myers, I can put one foot in the house and determine the condition of the home immediately by the sound. There's either too much noise or there's no noise at all. Or there's yelling or profanity or sarcasm or flesh hitting flesh or furniture hitting furniture." He said, "Depending upon what I hear, that's how I react. If I hear the wrong sound, I go to my room, turn down the lights and turn up the stereo and try to get lost. Or if I hear the wrong sound, I go to the phone and try to call somebody that I think will relate to the pain that I'm in. Or if the pain gets just too great, I'll go back out on the street because there's less pain there than there is in the home." And you know, he said something to me that's made as much sense as anything that I've ever heard since I've been in the program. He said, "You know, Mr. Myers, if the sound of your house is the same today as it was a year ago, chances are you're not growing." And I went home and I talked to Sally about that. I said, "You know, there even in sobriety, there are some painful things that we say to each other, and they hurt. And some of them are relatively simple. I mean, on a Friday night in sobriety, I would come home and I would say to Sally, 'How would you like to go out for dinner?' And she would say, 'Terrific.' And we would get in the car and we'd start down the freeway and I would say to her, 'Where would you like to go for dinner?' And she would say, 'I don't care.' And I would say, 'Well, let's go to Vincent's and get some seafood.' She says, 'I don't feel like seafood.' Let's go to the Split Rail and get some barbecue. I don't feel like barbecue." Now, I'll tell you, Vinoy told you earlier in the day, we're sensitive. And we don't handle rejection well. And it would be just a matter of seconds before the fight would start and the intensity would go up in the front seat of the car and I would yell at her and we'd go home. And so Sally and I have worked very, very hard to take the painful things out of our house. Last Christmas, the grandson called, and and the one that was just visiting. And he said, "Grandpa, I love to come to your house better than all the houses that I go to." And I said, "Why is that, Corey?" And he said, "Because it's quiet." And you know, I never really thought about the security of quiet. You know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, what it says to me when I come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, "Hey, stand still. Be quiet." You know, the big book is just laced with things like restraint of tongue and pen. Argument and fault finding are to be avoided like the plague. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. Our answers will come when our own house is in order. And over again, woven in and out of the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, is, "Hey, stand still." I put my arms around Sally that morning, and I finally got her out of the bathroom, and we took her to a psychiatrist. We always took her to a psychiatrist. We took her to 5 psychiatrists. Somehow, Sally and I fell in the trap that if we could get her fixed, I wouldn't drink so much. I don't know how we did that, but that's the way we had it figured out. And finally, this doctor in Connecticut said to us, "Hey, you're Iowa farm kids and you're out of your element. What you really need is to go back to Iowa, be surrounded by your family, and Albert, you don't travel and you'll be okay." And I want to tell you, Sally and I wrote that down. We put it down on paper, just like you'd construct the blueprints of a house. You know, that's an interesting thing, because the first house that I built for myself burned to the ground, and God has given me an opportunity to build another house. And not only that, He's given me the principles and the tools of the program to examine each 2x4 before I put it in there. And I remember we got back to Iowa and we bought just the right house in the right part of town. And we were close to the school and close to the church and close to friends and close to family. And the thing that we didn't write down there was the disease of alcoholism. And I became a pretty bad periodic drunk. And there used to be a fellow down in Lake Whitney, Texas, by the name of Bob White. And Bob used to say, "If you go on enough of those periodic drunks, they will show up in your living room." And he said, "I'm going to call them they because I don't know where they come from. And they usually show up when you need them the least." And I had been on this 4-day drunk, and sure enough, when I got back, they were in the living room. And they were saying to me, "You need to go to the alcohol and psychiatric clinic at the University of Iowa." And one thing about alcoholics, when we finally get cornered and the evidence becomes so tangible that we can't wiggle anymore, we begin to say funny things like, "Okay." And on a Monday morning at the Alcohol and Psychiatric Clinic at the University of Iowa, the psychiatrist that Sally and I had known socially was talking to me one more time about my behavior. And he said, "Albert, it seems to me that when you drink anymore, you hurt people." And I said, "That's right." And he said, "When you drink anymore, you get in all kinds of trouble." And I said, "That's true." He said, "Let me tell you a little something about alcohol." And I said, "Okay." He said, "Some people are allergic to strawberries. When they eat them, they break out in a rash. Your problem is when you get an ounce of alcohol in you, you have hives of the brain." And I remember, I looked at John and I said, "God, John, I'm allergic to alcohol." And he said, "Yeah, that's right." And he said, "What I suggest you do is you talk to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and you go to an AA meeting." And I remember on a Friday afternoon, a very busy Friday afternoon for this particular man who is now dead, a fellow by the name of Gil Voss, took a Friday afternoon and did for me what I had the pleasure and privilege of doing with Tracy. And he shared with me, and he told me about the shame and the guilt and the degradation and the DWIs and the separations and the bankruptcies. And I remember when he was telling me this story, just up here my mind said, "That hasn't happened. That hasn't happened. I haven't done that yet." I remember I went home and I told Sally, I said, "My God, you should have heard that story." I said, "It was terrible. If I get that bad, I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous." And in September of 1967, Sally and I went to our first AA meeting over on Melrose Avenue in Iowa City, Iowa, and a fellow stood up and said, "My name is, and I'm an alcoholic," and I told Sally, "Get me out of here. I am not like them." And I continued to do the periodic drinking, and the children began to leave. They would go off to college, and I thought, "Oh, how wonderful, they're going off to college." Hell, they never came back. I mean, once they had a chance to get out of that alcoholic home, they left. I remember my daughter wrote me a letter one time, says, "You'll always be my father, but my love for you will never be the same." And I read that passage over and over again, thinking, "My heavens, what have I done to destroy the relationship with my daughter? God, I don't want to be the way I am." And the oldest son was on the campus in the late 60s, and it was a very rebellious time, and he was into drugs and sold and jailed and trafficked and married and divorced with child before he was 20 and married another child without a marriage. And I remember Sally and I would just kind of, we'd sit in the kitchen and look at each other and say, what is going on with our family? What's happening? And I continued to drink, and they showed up one more time, and they said, we're going to take your house and sell it, and we're going to keep the equity. And we're going to give you some basic furniture to live with, and then we're going to auction off the furniture. And as I stand here tonight, and I'm thinking, looking down at Sally, that there's Sally and myself, and the children are standing on the lawn, the house is gone, the furniture's being auctioned off, and we never saw the disease of alcoholism. She never called me an alcoholic. I used a friend. I think Jim was talking about it earlier this morning. Somehow we just treat friends like disposable fruit. I don't know. We just squeeze all the good juice out and throw it away. And I had plenty of friends, and there was a time that I had none. And I used one more friend to get a job in Shreveport, Louisiana. And Sally and myself and the youngest son went to Shreveport. And I drank around the clock. I just existed from one day to the next. And one night at a place called Shreve Square, in Shreveport, Louisiana, I looked in the rearview mirror and I saw these red lights going around, and I thought, man, I'd better pull over as best I can, and I'll be careful because Caddo Perry's police deputies in Louisiana are mean. And I remember I could hardly get the car parked, and these two Caddo Perry's police deputies came around to the side of my car, and I rolled the window down, and they said, could we have your driver's license? And I said, sure, I was ready. I just handed it to them out the window, and then I made a terrible mistake. I rolled the window up, drove off, and left them standing there. That's a terrible move, I'll tell you. And the second time they got the car stopped, there wasn't any dialogue. They just pulled me out of the car, and I remember they threw me over the hood, and the handcuffs are going up the back, and the cars are going by, and my alcoholic mind is saying, God, I hope nobody's watching this, you know. And we get down to the Shreveport jail, and they do all the things they need to do, and finally, a guy said to me, hey, you can make a telephone call. And it scared me because I didn't have anybody to call. I really didn't. I thought, who could I call? Everybody that I had loved said, don't call. And being a good salesman, I called my best customer. I mean, that's what good salesmen do. But I want to tell you, God works in strange ways, because Frank came down and got me out of jail. And I remember I said to Frank, let's get a six-pack and go straighten this out. And he said, no. Why don't you come to my house and spend the night, and in the morning, we'll try to figure out what to do with you. And the way he said that, in the morning, we'll try to figure out what to do with me. God, I didn't want to be the way I was. I said, what is wrong with me? And I remember I watched a clock in his kitchen, and it got to be exactly 6 o'clock, and I called an Episcopal priest in Shreveport at Holy Cross Church, and I said, Father Paul, this is Albert, and I'm in big trouble. And he said, can you get down to the church? And I said, yes, I can. And I got down there and we began to talk. And he said, Albert, I want you to go to this halfway house. It's called the Bridge House on Stoner Avenue. And he said, there's a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor down there that I think you can relate to. And I thought, my God, how can I relate to a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor in a halfway house? But when you're cornered and the evidence becomes tangible and you can't wiggle anymore, you begin to say funny things like, okay. My sponsor says some of us get here because we see the light, others get here because they feel the heat. And that morning, the heat was on. And I went to this halfway house, and it was 10:30 on a Friday morning, and they sat me at the end of the table about where Tracy is, and there were three old railroad guys there, and I remember one of them said to me, when did you have your last drink? And I began to cry and pound the table, and it just began to pour out. And I said, God, I got these $1,200 worth of hot checks and this DWI, and the house is gone and the furniture is gone and three of the four kids are gone and Sally wants to leave and I'm about to get fired and they want to pick up the car. And one of them turned to the other one and said, boy, he sure sounds like one of us. And one of them said, would you do anything to get sober? I said, I'll do anything. I'll do anything. And one of them said, would you go to 7 meetings in a row? 7 meetings in a row? My God. And I looked around and, hey, these guys were talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw the slogans up on the wall. And I remember I bristled in this chair and I started to move, and this marvelous old Louisiana man put his arm around me and he said, "Albert, we need to go for a ride." He said, "I want you to go over to Shumpert Hospital with me and visit with a friend, and I want you to meet Sister Germaine." And I thought, boy, he's just, I know what he's doing. And we got in the car and we started towards the hospital, and he said, "You know, Albert, I never did quit drinking." And that's all he said. He didn't say any more, didn't say any less. And I started thinking about that. And man, that priest was right. I can relate to this guy. And I don't know how he's doing that, but I love the cure. And we met his friend, and we met Sister Germaine, and on the way back to the halfway house, he did it to me one more time, and he said, "You know, Albert, I never did quit drinking. As a matter of fact, I may have a drink tomorrow." I said, "Bill, how long have you been doing that?" He said, "What's that, Albert?" I said, "That not quit drinking." He said, "27 years, but I may have a drink tomorrow." But he said, "Albert, you have to understand, nobody ever took my right to drink away from me." Now, I don't know what I thought you were going to take away from me. We alcoholics have a hold of this rock, and we're going to the bottom of the lake, and everybody around us is saying, "Let go of the rock." And we're saying, "Hell no, it's mine, you know." But I said, "Bill, if this dumb thing works, God, you're going to take away my freedom." And this pathetic glaze just came over his face, and he said, "Your freedom?" He said, "Let's talk a little bit about your freedom." He said, "I have this dog that I put out in the backyard every day, and it's all fenced in." And he said, "He goes out there, and he plays, and he barks at the birds, and he soaks up the sunshine, and he has plenty to eat, and at night I come home and pick it up and love it and take it in the house." Now, he said, "I could let that dog be perfectly free and open up the back gate." And he said, "It could get out and run and be free and maybe get run over by a truck. Maybe go without food and starve. Maybe picked up by somebody that doesn't love it nearly as much as I do." He said, "Of the two freedoms, I think I'd rather be the dog on the inside of the fence." And he said, "You can be as big and as free as you want as long as you stay on the inside of the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." And Bill said to me, "You'll be at the halfway house at 10:30 every morning." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "You're not going to travel anymore." I said, "Bill, that's all I've ever known." He said, "I don't care." He said, "This is a relatively easy program. You just don't drink, and we're going to change every other area of your life." And I said, "What am I going to do, Bill?" And he said, "You're going to sell used cars." I said, "I've never sold used cars." And he said, "You're going to start." And I said, "Okay." And I want to tell you, I went to a man that I used to play golf with at the country club, and I asked him for a job, and he said, "Hey, I don't have one selling cars right now, but the offices need painted on the used car lot." And on the first 2 weeks of my sobriety, I painted the offices in the used car lot, and I was so grateful for it. And I remember he let me sell some used cars, and then I was able to sell some other ones. And it still kind of hurt me because everybody had a car to drive home except me. And I'd been there about a month and a half, and Mr. Donaldson called me in one night, and he said, "Albert, I'd like for you to have the biggest Dodge I have on the lot for you and Sally to enjoy this weekend." And I remember I had received a lot of awards and recognition, but nothing served me as well as that Dodge that weekend. And I remember I got in the car, and I drove home, and I picked up Sally, and I told her what had happened. And we didn't have much money. I remember we got some change, and we scraped it together, and I think we went to a Rexall drugstore and bought a cassette, Ray Conniff's Bridge Over Troubled Waters. And I remember we put it in that cassette, and we drove for about 48 hours straight, and we sang, and we played, and we held hands, and it was okay because we were in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill said to me, "You need to get a sponsor that you can relate to, somebody that you can talk to every day." Jim talked a little bit about this earlier in the day, and I said, "Bill, won't you be my sponsor?" He said, "I'll always be your sponsor, Albert, but you need somebody that you can relate to." He said, "There's a fellow that travels on the road for RCA, and he stays sober." I said, "You've got to be kidding." "A guy that actually travels on the road and stays sober?" He said, "Yeah." And he said, "I think he'd make a good good sponsor for you." And I said, "What's his name?" He said, "Hoss Ross." Did you ever notice who we turn our life over to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? On a Thursday night in Shreveport, Louisiana, at the Highland Group, I'm looking for a fella by the name of Hoss Ross. And I told a couple of the fellas, when Hoss comes in, let me know. And all of a sudden, this skinny guy came through the door, about 6'5", weighed 135 pounds, and he dressed all in one color. All blue, all green, all red, funniest looking guy you ever saw. And I went over to Hoss, and I said, Hoss, Ross, he said, yes. I said, they tell me you travel on the road for RCA and you stay sober. He said, that's right, son. I said, Hoss, would you be my sponsor? And he said, son, I'd be honored. He said, you have one of them big books? I said, not of my own. And I remember he bought me a big book, and he wrote in the front of it, to a long life in the fellowship, Hoss Ross, and then wrote his sobriety date. And he said, have you signed one of these cards to be a member here? And I said, no, I haven't. And that night he took me over and I signed a card to be a part of the Highland Group. And I want to tell you, Hoss called me every single day. You know, he would call and say, what are you doing, son? I'd say, nothing. He said, I'll be right over. And that lasted for about 2 weeks. And I remember I told Sally one night, I said, man, I've made a terrible mistake. I mean, I can't get rid of this guy. And Hoss called one night. He said, what are you doing, son? I said, I'm busy tonight, Hoss. He said, good, I'll do it with you. On December the 13th of 1973, Sally and I drove to Dallas, Texas, and we didn't know one soul. And I was driving a car that was co-signed by my sponsor. I was going to a job that had been arranged by my sponsor, and the money in my pocket to buy groceries had been given to me by my sponsor. And I will be forever grateful for the people who picked me up in the beginning and gave me the start. You know, Benoy said earlier today, and I believe it with all my heart, we're in this thing together. You and I are very fortunate to have a place where we can come ventilate our feelings and be safe, where the only thing that people have ever said to me is, I understand, we'll do it together. We have a way out, and I'm so grateful for that. We'd been in Dallas a couple years, and one weekend Sally and I were looking at houses. That's what alcoholics do. They don't have any money. They look at houses. And we were just trying to kill a weekend, and we were looking at this townhouse, and this lady was showing it to us, and she said, it's only $50,000, 5% down, 8.75% interest, 30-year loan. And Sally and I just looked at each other. We kind of laughed and giggled a little bit because we had tried to cash a $25 check the day before at a shopping center, and somebody wanted two major credit cards. We didn't have two major credit cards. I was lucky to have my driver's license. And I remember I called my sponsor on a Sunday night, and I said, you'll never guess what Sally and I are doing today. He said, what was that, Albert? I said, we were looking at houses. And he said, the devil you were. He said, tell me more about that. And I was telling Bill what we were doing, and he said, would you like to buy that house? And I said, well, of course. He said, well, you haven't forgotten about honesty yet, have you? And I said, no. He said, well, write a letter. I said, to who? He said, that loan committee that the lady was talking about. Did you ever notice how we alcoholics are scared to death of losing something we don't own anyway? Now, he said, this is what you do. He said, you write your name. This is where you work. This is your area of responsibility. This is what you make. You're a very active member of the Alpha Group, Alcoholics Anonymous, Dallas, Texas. And Sally works for this group of doctors, and this is her area of responsibility, and this is what she makes. She's a very active member of the Al-Anon family group, Alpha Dallas, Texas. And we wrote this letter, just like my sponsor told me to. And I remember we drove up on a Monday morning in front of the savings and loan, and Sally and I held hands. We got very quiet in the front seat of the car, and we said out loud, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And there was a quietness in the front seat of the car, and there was a strength that Sally and I hadn't felt in a long time, and there was that sensation of whatever happens will be okay. And I remember we went in and we sat across from this little loan officer, and he started asking all of the questions that alcoholics hate to answer. And we got down to credit, and I said to the man, we don't have any money and we don't have any credit. And if you want to see a strange look on a loan officer's face, try that. What I really wanted to say was my sponsor told me, but what I did was, hey, I said, here is a letter, and it will explain what Sally and I are trying to do with our life and what we're trying to do in your community. You give this to the loan committee and let them determine what we should do. And I want to say it was 5 or 6 weeks they called and said, come get your $50,000. And Sally and I started rebuilding our life in the community through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. One night Sally was having a meeting and a man came in and you could tell he was very troubled, and out of courtesy Sally just said, is there anything anybody would like to talk about? And boy, this guy, arm went up in the air, and Sally said, you know, could we help you? And for about an hour we tried to get a net over him. He just was going crazy. And at the end I went up and I said, my name's Albert. He said, my name's Jim. I said, what do you do, Jim? He says, I'm regional manager for Owens Corning Fiberglass. And I said, oh, all right. Yeah. And I became his friend and his sponsor. And one day Jim said to me, why don't you come back to work for Owens Corning Fiberglass? And I said, oh, God, Jim, you don't understand. I said, up there in my folder, there's a card that says, don't ever, don't ever. And he said, no, we've changed our position on that. He said, we have a very active employees assistance program. And of the 24,000 employees, over 2,000 of them are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, why don't you write a letter? And I wrote a letter, and they responded, and they said, we'd like a resume. And I knew they had a resume, so I just gave them an AA resume. Arrested, driving while intoxicated, jail, Shreveport jail. Sold used cars, 2 months. You know, I just sent it back up to Toledo. And they asked me to come up for interviews, and I remember the very first interview I had was a fellow that kind of the professional interviewer. And he just looked at me, and he had this funny smile, and he said, you know, I really can't ask you these questions, but I've been dying to meet you. He said, of all the years I've been with Owens Corning Fiberglass, I've never seen a resume where a guy starts out in jail. And the last interview was with my branch manager, who had been my branch manager in Kansas City. And it went a little like this. He said, Albert, how's Sally and the kids? I said, terrific. How's Marion and your children? He said, super. He said, are you ready to come back to work? And I said, yes. And they bridged 20-some years, and I went back to work. I'd been with them about a year, and I was playing racquetball one night, and I had a heart attack. I didn't know it. I didn't have the customary pain that goes with heart attacks. I just had kind of a nagging sensation in my back. And the following day, Sally and I went out for dinner, and that evening I said, hey, this is really beginning to hurt more than I would like. Let's just slip by Presbyterian Hospital and let them take a look at it. And they began to examine me, and all of a sudden the guy said, hey, you're going to feel better with these hoses up your nose and this IV in your arm and this nitro under your tongue. And I had a heart attack and shut down the whole right coronary area, and they had taken me up to intensive care. And if you know anything about coronary care units, they're very rigid, and they have plaques on the wall that say family only, limit to 2 minutes only, two people only. And Sally and one of the sons had just been visiting. I'm going in and out of the oxygen, and I'm wired for sound, and I saw Sally and the one son leave, and I kind of went out, and as I came to, this beautiful black guy that I sponsor standing at the end of my bed. And I said to Bob, I said, Bob, how the hell did you get in here? He said, I told him I was family. I said, what else did you tell him? He said, I told him you were my father. We really are family, I'll tell you that. I was in a cardiovascular class and had a second heart attack with no pain, and they said, hey, you've got a real problem here. You can't seem to monitor your disease. And I said, yeah, I've had that problem once before. Said, you need to go to the cardiologist. And I remember I went over to the cardiologist, and they did an angiogram and said, we need to do a triple bypass right away. And I remember, even as an alcoholic, we want to negotiate. You know, I talking to the surgeon, I said, what happens if I don't have the triple bypass? He said, you'll die. I said, oh, okay. You know, you just have to know. But I want to tell you that I've said this from the podium. I don't advocate open-heart surgery for an in-depth third step, but I want to tell you this. The night before open-heart surgery, you will do an in-depth third step. About 5 or 6 years ago, the daughter was having problems and said, Dad, can I come to Texas and bring the grandson? And I said, sure, honey, when are you coming? And she told me, and I said, you may want to pick another weekend because Mom's going to be up in Oklahoma. And she said, no, I think I'd like to come down and be with you. And I'm a father that's plagued with a tremendous amount of guilt where my children is concerned, and I'm a very tangible alcoholic, and somehow it doesn't seem enough for me to say to my daughter, I'm really sorry for what I did, and I'm sorry, and it won't happen again. Would you like a Seiko watch? I mean, somehow I just, you know, I just... And whenever we go shopping, Roxy is very careful not to point because, you know, I'm apt to say, well, let's go get it. And we were shopping, and I said to Roxy, hey, I seen this morning's paper where Mel Torme and George Shearing are playing at the Fairmont Hotel. How'd you like to have a fussy night on the town with your dad? And she said, I just love that. And I remember we got all prettied up, and we went down to this very fancy hotel in Dallas, and the maitre d' took us to our table, and the music began to play, and I said to Roxy, hey, how would you like to dance? And she said, just terrific. And I'm holding my gal, and we're dancing, and all of a sudden I heard her say, you're just the greatest dad in all the world. You're just the most wonderful person that I know. I just couldn't love you any more than I do. And, you know, I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous to be a good father or to be a good husband or to be a good anything. I came here to get the pain out and the heat off. And you gave me a set of principles that overpowered my personality and made me a functioning human being to my family and to my friends and to my community, and I will be forever grateful. Do you know how grateful I was that night to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as I'm holding my daughter? I have a relationship with Roxy today that I didn't dream was possible. The oldest son that got into drugs somehow continued to have all kinds of problems, and they called from Austin one time, and he was in jail on two counts of criminal mischief, and they told me the attorney was going to be $2,000, and the bail was set, and I remember writing a check for $2,000, and as I'm writing the check, I'm sending it to Austin knowing that I'm doing the wrong thing. I mean, hell, I've been in the program 12, 13 years, and I know when I'm writing the check that I'm crippling the son, and I'm doing it because the guilt won't let me do otherwise. And about 3 or 4 months later, they called again, and he was back in jail on criminal harassment, and the bail had gone up, and the attorney's fees had gone up, and we were talking, and I can't tell you why I did this or how I did it. Just in the middle of our conversation, I said, Chuck, I'm not going to play anymore. I love you like a rainbow, but it's over for me. I don't know how you got in, and I don't know how you're going to get out, but know that I love you. And I put the phone down, and I stood there, and I was stunned, and my heart was broken, and my emotions wouldn't work, and I couldn't think of anybody to call, and I sat there, and all of a sudden I called an Al-Anon. I called your Al-Anon speaker that talked this afternoon. And I said, Vinoy, I've just said no to my son for the first time in 12 years, and God, my heart is broken. And she said, of course it is, Albert. You're a father, and it's going to hurt. But you got to work the steps. And I said, damn it, Vinoy, I know the steps. And she said, yeah, but you ain't working them. And I remember saying to Vinoy, hey, Vinoy, help me. And she said, well, say out loud, you're powerless over your son, and he makes your life unmanageable. And I want to tell you, we're standing there, and I'm talking to Vinoy, and I'm saying, I'm powerless over Chuck, and he makes my life unmanageable. And I said that out loud. You know, I had intellectualized that 100 times. I had never done it with my heart. And all of a sudden, this light went on. I'm powerless over Chuck, and he makes my life unmanageable. That's the way that is. And she said, you're going to... A power greater than yourself is going to restore him to sanity. And I said, that's right. A power greater than myself is going to restore him to sanity. My power is not taking him anywhere. As a matter of fact, my power is gone. And we're going to turn his will and his life over to the care of God as we understand him. God, if I turn my will over to God and I turn his will over to God, I don't have to worry about that anymore. And then I remember Vinoy said to me, write down a couple things that make you feel guilty about your son. And I didn't even hesitate. I remember I wrote down, made him do things that he didn't want to do when he was small. I'm a frustrated jock, and I wanted him to play competitive sports. And every time the sun was shining, man, my foot was in the middle of his back, and you will play. And you'll play basketball, and you'll play football, and you'll play track, and you'll do everything. God had gifted him as an artist and a poet and a journalist. I used to hold him up against the wall, and I'd just get his eyeballs about that big around, and I'd say, damn you, if you just get your hair cut, if you just go to school on time, you just get your grades up, if you just do what I tell you to do, you could be just like me. And he used to look out and say, I'll do anything but be like you. That's okay, baby. I remember I had him up there one time, and he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, you're insane. And I said, how dare you talk to me like that? By God, I put the clothes on your back and the food on the table and the roof over your head. If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't have what you have. And I didn't know how true that was. And I didn't see Chuck for almost a year. And then I went down to Austin. We played golf. And some more time passed, and he came up to Dallas. Last Father's Day, he sent me a great big card. And on the front of it was a monkey all dressed up like Humphrey Bogart. Trench coat, tilted hat, cigarette. And as you opened it up, on the inside, the caption was, "Here's looking at you, Dad." And then down below it had, "P.S. I just want to tell you how proud I am of what you've done with your life. You've certainly given me something to look up to." And when Vinoy said today, "Hey, I touched her daughter. Don't you know that she touched my son?" And to me, that's how this works. The youngest son, who just had so much hate for Sally and I that he kept a loaded shotgun in his bedroom when I first got sober. Matter of fact, he couldn't stand my sobriety in the beginning, and he had to go live with a family in Louisiana for 6 months. Several years ago, John said, "Dad, I need to talk to you." And we were having lunch, and he said, "Dad, every once in a while I find myself drinking with people that I don't like to drink with. Did that ever happen to you?" And I said, "A couple times." And he said, "Sometimes, Dad, I find myself drinking in places that I don't want to be. Did that ever happen?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "Sometimes, Dad, I start the evening out with $200 or $300, and in the morning I've only got 10 or 20. Did that ever happen to you?" And I said, "Of course." And he said, "What do you think?" I said, "About what?" "I've never seen you drunk. If you've got a problem, let me do this for you. If you've got a problem and there's pain in your life, I'm going to give you the names of two people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to give you their home phone, and I'm going to give you their business phone. As a matter of fact, one of the names that I gave to my son is your afternoon speaker tomorrow." And I said to John, "John, if the pain in your life gets so bad that you can't handle it anymore, you talk to them. They have a way out. And the reason that I'm doing that is very simple. I'm your father, and I'm afraid I will kill you. Where it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, working with others, I can work with your kids. I just can't seem to work with mine. I can't get the complete acceptance without expectations. But I sleep very well in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing one thing for sure. I'll save your kids, and you will save mine." Sally and I have been married 40 years, and that's a long time. Chronologically, that's a long time. And I had to come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that having a good relationship is not finding the right person, it's being the right person. My having a good love affair with my wife doesn't have anything to do with my wife, really has everything to do with my behavior. When my behavior is good, my love affair is good. When my behavior is bad, my love affair is bad. You've given Sally and I a love and a tenderness and a dignity for each other that we've never known before. And we're still learning how to touch and feel and not be afraid of each other. But I want to tell you, love is not looking at each other, it's looking in the same direction. I can't tell you how grateful I am tonight to be here, because I need you more tonight than first night I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not much of a gamble when you don't have anything to lose. As I stand here tonight, I have a great deal to lose. If Sally could come up here with me right now, and she'll be up in just a little while, and the four children were here to come up, they would tell you what I'm about to tell you. We're in gratitude that you've given us our life back. We love you very, very much, and if I had a wish and a prayer for you, it would be a slow recovery. Don't drink, read the big book, and go to meetings. Thank you.